today on Against the Grain. When historically have workers, not capitalists, had the upper hand? How about when the U.S. was at war and any large-scale disruption to war industries was anathema to ruling elites? I'm C.S. Robert Ovitz joins me to discuss his new book, When Workers Shot Back, Class Conflict from 1877 to 1921, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. According to today's guest, during World War I, worker-instigated disruption of industry in the U.S. put in doubt not only the outcome of the war, but also the very survival of capitalism. If workers stopped working, if they brought industrial production to a halt via strikes or other forms of labor militancy, the war effort would have been seriously undermined, if not stopped in its tracks. So did workers at that time understand the kind of leverage they had? And if so, how did they flex their power? What did factory owners and ruling elites do in response? What efforts did they make to keep workers on the job and keep the war economy humming? In his new book, Robert Ovitz describes the nature and scale of worker unrest, and also how the U.S. government, during World War I, put in place a labor regime, an administrative apparatus for pacifying workers, a regime that anticipated the labor planning mechanisms established during the New Deal. Robert Ovitz is a lecturer in political science at San Jose State University. He also teaches at De Anza College. His new book is When Workers Shot Back, Class Conflict from 1877 to 1921. When Robert joined me recently in studio, I asked him about the book's underlying and unifying theme.
My interest is in understanding how reforms that we spent a lot of time celebrating and defending actually came about in the 1930s, the reforms that we refer to as the New Deal. Most specifically, the parts of the New Deal that deal with the rights of labor to organize in the National Industrial Recovery Act and the National Labor Relations Act, Social Security, the Fair Labor Standards Act. I wanted to understand how did these actually come about, because the dominant thinking is that strikes in the 1930s during the Depression actually prompted the Roosevelt administration and the Democrats in Congress to actually pass these laws. And in the process of following up on my own interests in some of the very confrontational and violent strikes in 1877 and 1894, I started to realize that actually this history is several decades off. And so what prompted it was to understand how do we change the state? How do we bring about the kinds of changes, reforms, concessions that are long overdue today? Do we have to wait around for politicians who are sympathetic to actually get laws passed and regulations implemented, or even the Supreme Court to step in and review laws and the failure to enforce existing laws and so forth? Or do we mobilize? Do we organize? Do we disrupt? And does disruption lead to these kinds of reforms? So the very fundamental question that kind of prompted me to look at this period was, how does reform happen? How does it come about? Does it come about because disruption forces concessions, or because you get sympathetic elected officials who go into office and make those changes on our behalf because they care about suffering or injustices in society?
Why did you begin this book with the 1877 railroad strike?
Well, the railroad strike came at a very, very fascinating transitional period in American history. This is essentially the end of Reconstruction. And Reconstruction was that period, of course, of reconstituting the country as a single country, bringing the former Confederate states back in, forcing them to change their state constitutions and uphold the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And integrate African Americans and others into society as equal citizens. But what a lot of people have forgotten is at the end of Reconstruction, was not just the end of that project of a second wave of racial democracy, if you will, but it was also the beginnings of the use of the state as a class weapon to attack organized workers who were increasingly moving into cities and emerging factories and mines from the countryside. We were moving from an agricultural to an industrial society. And also it was the end, I should say, of the genocidal wars against Native Americans. And so at the same time, these other two things were happening. In some ways, the war against industrial workers organizing was also happening. And that really exploded in the 1877 railroad strike, which is actually the first strike that I decided to focus on in the book. And so the book stretches from 1877, from the 1877 railroad strike, which shut down much of the country by self-organized workers, until 1921, what is otherwise known as the Miners' War, the Redneck Miners' War, the Redneck Army in West Virginia. So I looked at this four-decade period to understand, how does change happen? How do we change laws? How do we change institutions and policies?
The 1894 railroad strike, that, as I understand, disrupted the national economy for about 2 weeks. So is there a way you can kind of encapsulate what you wanted to express about this very large labor mobilization?
Well, what differed in the 1894 strike and the 1877 strike was, in the earlier strike, there was really no existing union. The workers self-organized. They spread the news using the telegraph and pamphlets that they sent along on the trains, and for about 10 days shut down much of the country. In 1894, there was a brand new union called the American Railway Union, and it was led by a famous many-time presidential candidate, Eugene Debs. Later on, he would run for president. And they used this fledgling union. The workers, the rank and file of the union, forced the leadership, which was very small, of this new union to call a sympathy strike, to boycott all the trains that were pulling Pullman cars. These were luxury cars, kind of like BMW train cars, and or Lamborghini, I guess. And the Pullman workers had gone on strike in this company town outside of Chicago, and they were losing. And this spread out of control, and the union essentially couldn't stop the strike. And it shut down much of the country. And just like in 1877, the National Guard were called. Then they were militias. But the National Guard and the military were called. But just like in 1877, workers also took up arms to defend the strike and disrupted essentially the entire economy, and probably had some implications for the international economy at the time, because the railroads were the ones that controlled the telegraph, and telephones were relatively new. So a lot of trading and business was done through the telegraph. And so, much like in 1877, workers had self-organized, but in this case, they used the union as a way to spread the strike around the country.
And unionization is one theme of this book, the extent to which unions organized or were permitted to organize. And we've agreed to talk about the period before and during World War I. There was a huge strike wave there. To what extent was unionization allowed or practiced in the years leading up to World War I?
Well, that's kind of a complicated answer that I would have to give you. The dominant union from the last few decades of the 1800s was primarily craft unions. They were all white. They had Jim Crow locals, but they were essentially all white. They were highly skilled. They controlled the tempo of the work, their productivity, and thus they controlled their wages. They didn't really see themselves as connected to the growing numbers of unskilled, mostly immigrant workers and black workers. And it was called the American Federation of Labor. And so they had very few contracts. They had a relatively small membership, but they were the dominant union of the previous decades. There had been other attempts to organize all workers into unions regardless of their skills. For example, the Industrial Workers of the World and the Knights of Labor in previous decades. But at the beginning of World War I, you had the IWW, which primarily was in the West and in the mining areas in agriculture and timber, and then you had the AFL controlling essentially good chunks of industry. But unionization was effectively illegal. There were no federal rights, except for railroad workers, to organize and obligate employers to collectively bargain with them. Employers could hire thugs, as they often did, and beat up any worker that tried to agitate or organize. And they could drive them out of town. They could use local elites to imprison them. Essentially, to organize was to put your life on the line. Railroad workers in those previous two strikes I talked about had been blacklisted, many of them prevented from ever working not only in the railroads, but as they integrated with steel and the iron trades, especially under U.S. Steel, they were prohibited from working in most industries. But this book, while it's about unionization, it's really more about how workers self-organize. Formal unions played a very different role. The AFL was more of a, I like to say, a leash on workers. It was a way to manage and control workers in order to justify having a contract that established certain conditions, productivity agreements, and wages. And so the contract became a way of managing workers to keep them from disrupting work. And because so little of the workforce, about 6-7% at the start of World War I were unionized, the sky was the limit. You could use whatever tactics and strategies that you could get away with in order to extract concessions, which many times did happen.
Robert Ovitz joins me in studio. He teaches political science at San Jose State University and De Anza College, and his book is When Workers Shot Back: Class Conflict from 1877 to 1921. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. What happened to the frequency of strikes in the U.S. in the, 3 to 5 years preceding the U.S.'s formal entry into World War I?
So in the years preceding the U.S.'s entry into World War I, the most fascinating worker organizing was happening among the IWW. The IWW believed in workers controlling the economy, controlling work. They didn't negotiate contracts. And there was also some really fascinating efforts to organize in the structural iron and bridge industry, which was also another chapter in the book. But for the most part, unions were incredibly weak. Unionization had declined. The number of workers under contracts was very low. Strikes had declined. It looked kind of similar to the way it is today. Huge trusts controlled much of the economy, like U.S. Steel. However, once World War I began, the U.S. started selling a lot of weaponry and ammunition to our allies in Europe. We were loaning them the money as well, right?
And this is before its formal entry into the war. It was supporting the allies.
That's absolutely right. Strikes actually broke out in New England in the war industry. And most of the strikes that happened in 1915, 1916 were actually carried out by self-organized workers. They were wildcat strikes in to some degree, where they did have some union presence. And many of those workers were women. In small and large arms manufacturers. And in fact, there was a general strike on May 1st, 1916, that was called by the Metal Workers Union, the IAM, in 35 cities in New England. There was a lot of class antagonism that was on the rise at that point.
Why was there so much worker unrest in the years leading up to the U.S.'s entry into World War I? Did workers understand that their efforts were crucial to supplying the Allies with what those Allies needed to prosecute the war, and therefore the workers felt they could demand more from their employers?
That's an excellent question. And I think that those workers, I can't tell you what they were specifically thinking, but their actions seem to tell us that they understood that they had immense leverage. They were in industries that were crucial to a major priority of the Wilson administration, which was helping the Allies prosecute the war. And they knew that they were in a critical, what some referred to as, they had strategic power. They had high-level strategic power. They had the ability to disrupt a significant portion of the war industry just by striking in these critical factories and plants that were supplying these weapons and ammunition. And so these small strikes had a reverberation of effort. When the employers ended up settling, many of these strikes were very successful. They reduced their work hours, they raised their wages, and then it spread on May 1st, 1916. These workers realized we actually have the ability to self-organize and actually extract concessions without a union, without a formal union. And it's quite extraordinary. So this high-level strategic power carried on once the U.S. entered into World War I, and the Wilson administration immediately realized that we've got a huge problem on our hands. We need to ramp up industrial production to supply all the weapons, and you know there was a lot of technological innovation in World War I. You know, tanks and barbed wire and gas weapons and airplanes were first being used in World War I. And this prompted an immediate transformation in the way that the state extended its power and influence into the economy. Really, for the first time, the state, and here I don't mean like Texas or California, but the state government, the national government, realized that they needed to play a role in managing class conflict.
So in what ways did the Wilson administration, the federal government, intervene in a way that it thought could minimize worker disruption and keep the war industry going?
Well, when these strikes started happening and continued to escalate, especially in 1917 and 1918, there were a number of citywide general strikes, about five. The Wilson administration's response was to establish a regulatory mechanism by which in each of these separate critical industries, shipbuilding, iron and steel, other manufacturing sectors, they established commissions and boards that would serve as a kind of arbiter to reconcile these conflicts between the workers and the companies. And it turned out to be a kind of ABC chaotic bureaucratic structure that had really no central organizing core to it. Each of these different bodies would respond to workers threatening to strike or actually striking by intervening, bringing the workers, if they had a union, their union or whoever, you know, the self-organized workers would send to these meetings with the companies. And they would say, look, we need you back to work. We want you to raise wages. We want you to maintain productivity in exchange for not striking. And so over the period from April 1917, when the U.S. enters into the war, and even before that, some of them had already been set up, but from April until the following April, a whole number of these different arbitration bodies had been set up. But there was no coordinating structure. And so in April 1918, Wilson issues an executive order that establishes the National War Labor Board. And it takes predominance over all of the other boards. And so the Wilson administration in this way is creating a kind of proto labor relations, or what I call the labor planning state. And this is about two decades before the Roosevelt Democrats' New Deal.
Right. So you're kind of arguing that it anticipates or foreshadows the kind of labor mechanisms that were put in place by FDR?
Absolutely. And they play a very important role that will inform what FDR will do later. They realize that they can't suppress class conflict because that would be very disruptive. They would have to shut down production. So they set up the process by which workers could petition the National War Labor Board, and they would send in investigators as long as the workers hadn't gone on strike yet. They would investigate very quickly, sometimes in a matter of days. They would issue a ruling, and they would award everything from equal pay for equal work for women workers to higher wages to shorter work weeks, as long as the workers promised not to go on strike. In fact, Samuel Gompers, AFL president, the chairman of one of these board's committees, actually issued a no-strike pledge that AFL workers would not go on strike. And even though the AFL officially didn't oppose that position, many of these workers actually were members of the AFL. but they organized their entire plant. And so, ironically, many of these strikes still happened and still involved AFL workers, even though they had gotten a relatively good settlement that was supposed to have sent them back to work. So the Wilson administration's strategy here was to manage class conflict, not repress it, but manage it by incorporating the AFL into the state management bureaucracy while granting some concessions to workers and some concessions to employers. In other words, splitting it down the middle, bringing about some sort of compromise that will later on emerge as what we still have today, we call collective bargaining.
Robert Ovitz is his name. He is a lecturer in political science at San Jose State University. He also teaches at De Anza College. And we are talking about his new book. It's called When Workers Shot Back, Class Conflict from 1877 to 1921. It's published by Brill. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Tell us more about this National War Labor Board's activities. And given the government's interest in keeping the war economy going and that workers had leverage in this regard, one would think that the National War Labor Board would in some senses be forced to favor workers over employers in their rulings.
The board acted as an arbitrator. It would investigate, it would send inspectors out, and sometimes it even went to the National Board, which was actually co-chaired by former President Taft and a radical labor lawyer, strange, odd couple. But they would issue their own decision. And they had about 1,200 complaints in just the 11 months or so that it existed. And they issued about 500 or so awards. But you can't say that these awards actually were wins for workers. They were small, incremental concessions. And the employers, the companies got the workers back to work. Production kept humming, productivity growing. And so it achieved that goal of avoiding disruption, at least in the short term. So you can't actually say that the awards were victories for one side or the other. But here's the rub, is that this entire labor planning process didn't really work because there was nothing obligating the workers to not find new grievances and then threaten to go on strike a few weeks or a few months later, or spreading it to the other plants of the same company or other plants in the same city. And so ironically, even though you had this entire labor planning process, all these different bodies and the National War Labor Board in place, the number of strikes really didn't decline. In fact, there were about 6,000 strikes in the 18 months that the U.S. was involved in World War I.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. What did government intervention in the form of the National War Labor Board, you know, taking up a case, for example, do to the costs of worker escalation, you know, escalating a conflict and going on strike or threatening to go on strike?
This gets at the heart of one of the sub-themes of my book. Your question is that in this case, because the state had a predominant interest to make sure that disruption was minimized, this essentially reduced the cost to workers to organize and to escalate their tactics and disrupt the production process without having to go through the process of organizing a formal union. In fact, the National War Labor Board refused to allow new unions to be set up if they didn't already exist. So the costs were very low for these workers. Remember, we're at war. Millions of men are being drafted. There's a labor shortage. And so if workers didn't go on strike, they would just hop from one job to the next, kind of like today, right? And the way to raise your wage without organizing is just go to a job that pays more. And so the combination of high turnover and disruption effectively had the result of encouraging workers to actually engage in more disruption. And so you actually had a strike wave at the same time you had this labor planning process. Between 1914 and 1918, the number of strikes increased almost fourfold, and the number of workers actually on strike increased eightfold. So it lowered the costs, it increased the opportunities. And when those conditions exist, you're going to see a lot more confrontational escalation of tactics, more disruption, because it's more likely that the employers are going to have to give something to get them to go back to work and to restore production. When workers realize that the opportunities are very high and the threats are low, this provides an incentive for others to mimic the tactics and strategies of those who've been successful. And that's when you get these kinds of waves that happen. And doing it where the state is more likely to intervene to keep employers from carrying out repression because it would disrupt the rest of the economy.
It's interesting because on the one hand, as you're telling me, the National War Labor Board framework, in a sense, encouraged worker militancy. You also write that the effect of the framework was to integrate self-organized workers into the labor planning state. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, actually, there's this kind of dark side to this, and that's where I'm going with this, is that what Wilson's administration put into place, they abandoned immediately. As soon as the war ended in November 1918, they said, it's all done. And then the National War Labor Board kind of teetered on for a few more months until it shut down. And employers refused to abide by any more of these awards because there was no statutory obligation to do so. But what they essentially did was it was kind of a practice run of what role can the state play in managing the class struggle. It failed miserably because, as I just talked about, the strike wave continued. And more workers even joined the AFL. But where they succeeded, and this is where the Roosevelt Democrats really kind of discovered a few decades later, is that using the labor planning process by extending it into what we call collective bargaining, you can actually turn the unions into the means of managing class struggle. If employers are obligated to come to some sort of contractual agreement with the unions, there's a statutory power behind it. It can be enforced in the courts of law or in the case of labor unions in the national labor infrastructure that manages and oversees it, the National Labor Relations Board. So you can use it as a leash to control and suppress class conflict. So Wilson's attempt to do that didn't succeed, but Roosevelt perfected it. And what that effectively did was it split the self-organized workers from their leadership. The AFL moved into the Democratic Party, where it remains today. It became a key part of the Democratic Party coalition, and it's used as a way to manage and prevent disruption by self-organized workers. So when workers self-organize today, they form a union, and then they're contractually obligated to follow the terms of the contract. But then the AFL became part of the Democratic Party, but many of the workers still didn't really recognize the AFL leadership, and they continued to strike against the interests of the leadership. So this is one of the dynamics I call the paradox of success. That's where when you're successfully extracting concessions, the leadership gets split off because it moves into the coalition of the party that's willing to respond to your demands. And then the grassroots or the rank and file become isolated from the leadership and lose control over the leadership. This is very endemic in most successful social movements.
Robert Ovetz, O-V-E-T-Z, lecturer in political science at San Jose State University. His book is When Workers Shot Back, Class Conflict from 1877 to 1921. We'll take a short break and speak more with Robert. Please stay with us. Thank you. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Robert Ovitz joins me in studio. He teaches political science at De Anza College and at San Jose State University. His work focuses on contingent labor and worker self-organization at the turn of the 20th century. And his new book is When Workers Shot Back, Class Conflict from 1877 to 1921. What did the National War Labor Board do in terms of bureaucratizing the struggle of workers against management? And to what degree do you think bureaucratization is part of the legacy of this effort to manage class struggle?
That played a huge role in figuring out how to manage these class conflicts. The National War Labor Board, of course, was kind of flying by the seat of its pants. It was trying to figure out what the rules and the process were. But they issued essentially eight fundamental principles. And one of the key fundamental principles by which it would function was that they would not arbitrate any strike. Workers could not be on strike. Now, there were some exceptions to this. But for the most part, this encouraged workers to just threaten to strike. And then that would bring in the National War Labor Board. But just that rule itself began the process of imposing a kind of bureaucratic rationale over class conflict. And what that essentially meant was that now the workers had to redirect their efforts to convincing these investigators and inspectors that they had a legitimate grievance. And then they would have to wait, and it was very fast compared to today, but you know, they'd have to wait a few days or maybe a few weeks to get an answer. And sometimes, though, the workers weren't that patient. They weren't willing to wait around the plant, go back to work until they issued their award. And there was even this one case where these workers threatened to go on strike at GE. And they just decided, we're just going to go to D.C. and we're going to show up at the board. And they literally chastised former President Taft. It was a pretty extraordinary transcript. And the names of these workers has not been saved. But Taft feels threatened and says, you know, I don't feel like having a gun stuck to my head. And these workers said, we never intended to do that, but we just want you to give us an answer. So sometimes the workers would refuse to go along with the bureaucratic process. But in terms of the process that they established is the rulings themselves were good illustrations of how bureaucratic the whole system was becoming. They would never allow the workers to form a formal union. They never obligated the employers to collectively bargain with those workers. If they had a union already on the shop floor, then they would do that. But they would not allow new unions. Instead, what they did was they required that a so-called shop committee be set up. And so then the workers' focus would be away from disruption into now competing to try to get elected to the shop committee, which would then – European countries have some form of this. This is essentially where they got the idea and from Canada. And then these workers would campaign. So then it would be turned into an election campaign. They'd try to get on these committees. But often those committees were stacked and became yellow unions. They were essentially corporate unions. And then they would have to have these long, long meetings in order to address the grievances. So the bureaucratization of the National War Labor Board was intentional. It was to slow down and moderate and diffuse the struggle and turn it into a kind of prototype of what will later become a kind of worker management committee. They did some other things as well. They would review the wage scales, and then they would meet with different, you know, groups of workers and present to them where they should be on the wage scale. So it became very much diffused and distracted away from the conflict and into writing new rules.
One theme of this book has to do with the composition of power, of worker power, of the power of companies and of capital, and the recomposition of these elements of society, these forces within society over time. So in the context of the World War I strike wave, how do you see worker power specifically being composed or recomposed?
In some ways, it's kind of an unwieldy combination, but I try to combine the ideas of Charles Tilly and his tactical repertoire that social movements use with autonomous Marxist analysis of the class composition. In this particular case of these wildcat strikes during World War I, I see this as an example of a recomposition of workers' power, where workers are put together in situations where they have the ability to disrupt production. And they design and devise new tactics and strategies in order to do that, in order to extract these concessions that we've been talking about. And in the process of doing that, though, they have to very carefully study the current organization of capital. They have to understand the production and industrial process, or what we also call the technical composition of capital. How is capital organizing the production process? And here I'm just talking about industrial production. And so there's some interesting folks who are involved in helping spark these strikes who've come out of the Wobbly movement. One organizer with the metal workers in particular, Lavitt, is very good at understanding how critically situated they are and how capital is organized, particularly in the New England region. And they realize that these plants are all interconnected, that if they disrupt the metal production plant, they will disrupt ammunition production and weapons production and several other sectors as well as that rely on the metal. So by understanding the organization of capital or capital's technical composition, workers are able to recompose their power. In the process of recomposing their power, they're able to disrupt production, which then leads to these changes in the way that the state regulates labor relations, and in the process of the state transforming labor relations, decomposes those workers' power. And effectively, the way they do that is, once the war ends, there's no more mechanism for arbitrating these conflicts. Employers have no constraints, and they just fire everybody. And they particularly target the key organizers, like Lavitt, for example, who's literally driven out of town by the Committee of Public Information, and even Wilson's daughter is involved in persecuting him. And they get rid of the workers who know how capital is organized. And so what you end up with is, in 1919, there's a massive strike wave, the Seattle General Strike in Kansas City and so forth, the steel strike. But after 1919, after those general strikes are for the most part defeated, we then go into a decade of what we call the decomposition of working classes. In other words, where not only is unionization fall, but strikes almost disappear, class conflict is submerged, and we know the rest of the story of the 1920s.
Robert Ovitz, he teaches political science at San Jose State University. His book is When Workers Shot Back, Class Conflict from 1877 to 1921. You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. What had the emerging assembly line done to workers' ability to connect with one another and to the vulnerability of capitalists to worker disruption?
Well, the assembly line is more than just the physical manifestation of this constant tempo of movement of pieces that workers are in place assembling. The assembly line is part of a larger rationalization of industrial production that is really kind of engineered literally and figuratively and theoretically by Frederick Taylor. Taylor's reputation goes beyond his actual successes. He really only reorganized a few dozen workplaces. But Taylor's influence is still with us today. What Taylor did was he broke down the movements of skilled workers, and he recorded their movements and taught those movements to mid-level managers. And they combined the movements and they timed them and they figured out ways to cut the amount of time it took to make each movement. And so in the rationalization of the labor process, this emerges as what we call the assembly line. It's kind of shorthand for how industrial production changes, where a single worker produced virtually the entire product to a whole bunch of workers producing it by doing small microscopic steps in the industrial process. And it had tremendous effect. First of all, it increased the size of plants, and it increased the number of workers working in a single place. And because we're going from an agricultural to industrial society over the previous two decades, more and more workers who have strong community connections from the rural communities are moving into these teeming cities where now they're bringing in their experiences of community connections and solidarity in the rural countryside into the cities. And at the same time, there's, of course, millions of immigrants that are also coming in to the United States from Asia, from Europe, and they're moving into these cities and moving into these factories. And so these factories bring together large numbers of workers. And even though many of them are divided by language and race and ethnicity, they also have many connections and many experiences from their home countries or their home rural communities. And this is the source of a conflagration of these wildcat strikes. Many of these workers brought their previous experience of organizing into the workplace. And since there were such a large number of them, you really only needed to have a fraction of those workers to participate in a walkout to shut down the entire production process. Because the assembly line is a very linear process. It's highly centralized, highly regimented. So all you had to do is disrupt it in one place to disrupt the entire production process. So the combination of these social characteristics of these workers and their recomposition depends on their ability to recognize the resources that they have and bring into the workplace allows them to overcome this new technical composition of the rationalization of work in the assembly line.
And what did the de-skilling of work that accompanied the assembly line, the emergence of the assembly line, due to the American Federation of Labor's emphasis on skilled workers, on workers who, you know, I guess before the assembly line, kind of made everything themselves and were considered skilled?
Yeah, the de-skilling had a multiplicity of effects. First of all, it made skilled workers, as you're saying, far less important in the production process. And because the AFL was stuck on this organizing only skilled white male workers, it was shrinking in influence and in power. And it was constantly challenged by unions like the Knights and the IWW, who believed in organizing all the workers, not only in a single plant, but in an entire industry, regardless of their race and their gender or their skill level. And so the AFL was seeing its power and influence shrinking because they would organize only the skilled workers in a plant where more and more of the workers were unskilled immigrant workers, people of color, women. And so the AFL workers would say, go on strike, and they would lose because the plant was still operating. And so in some ways, World War I led to the rejuvenation of the AFL, because many of its members had been dissatisfied with the way the AFL was not organizing industrially. And they were influenced by this emerging idea of industrial unionism that I just described. And so the wildcat strikes involved large numbers of workers across these different lines. And so in some ways, the AFL's strategies and tactics were corrupt, and they were bankrupt, and they were failing miserably. And these wildcat strikes actually led to its, in some way, a kind of brief rejuvenation. But it also introduced to these unskilled workers their power. It allowed them to realize that they had tremendous power to disrupt the workplace, and they didn't have to rely on the AFL, and they could form their own workers' organizations.
So in what sense, then, was the AFL rejuvenated, given the forces kind of against what it was doing, contrary to its efforts during this period?
Well, the AFL became incorporated into the Democratic Party, where it remains to this day. It wasn't Roosevelt. It was Wilson that actually did that. And by doing that, the AFL found itself in a peculiar situation. To remain part of the elite coalition of the Democratic Party, it had to deliver labor peace. But at the same time, it also had to deliver improvement in conditions for its membership. So while its membership grew until 1920, at least, it was caught in this paradox of success. It has to deliver now. It has to serve two masters. And you fast forward to the 1930s, and there's a rejection of the AFL. The CIO emerges from industrial workers. It's a little bit more open to non-white workers, not very much. But eventually the AFL, of course, is absorbed into the CIO, right? But the AFL enters into formal politics, which it had resisted even a few years earlier. But it doesn't form its own labor party. And so it gets submerged within the elite-dominated Democratic Party.
So we've been talking about strikes and work stoppages, often without the sanction of a union, or despite even the presence of a union in a workplace. What about acts of disruption that took place on the shop floor? What kinds of tactics did workers undertake in response to efforts by management to increase productivity and speed up the work process?
What really leads to this wildcat strike wave are self-organized workers who, through the process of engaging in everyday forms of refusal of work, start to discover that they can actually disrupt the industrial process through very small acts of turning off machines or breaking a belt. And then they start to coordinate it with one another by taking turns in different parts of the plant of shutting down parts of the assembly line or the production process. These are what I call the unknown committees. And it's on the basis of these self-organized unknown committees of these workers whose names we'll never know because they were never recorded. Many of them didn't write anything. Their names aren't recorded in the records. Even in the National War Labor Board hearings, they didn't even record their names. But it's these anonymous workers that by disrupting productivity, because remember, the work weeks for many of these workers, the best work week was 48 hours, 6 days a week. And so to compensate for their inability to shorten their work week or raise their wages, they would impose a reduction in productivity by disrupting production. That explodes into these overt strikes or threats to strike that brings about these concessions. But once World War I's over, this problem actually returns. It becomes even greater. There was a massive study that was done in the 1920s that found that even plants that had no unions, no known members of unions, still faced problems of very low productivity, and they couldn't figure out why. And there was this one industrial sociologist by the name of Matheson who conducted the main part of this body of studies. And he found that workers where they lacked unions were very likely to still kind of raise their wages and reduce productivity by using everyday forms of resistance. And this was in the 1920s. And this was actually seen earlier by the Commission on Industrial Relations that actually one of their reports that had been censored and never filed with their other reports, I actually tracked it down. It took a couple of years. But this report actually made the argument that where unions are lacking, it doesn't mean there isn't some sort of class conflict. Workers are engaged in these everyday forms of refusal and resistance. And so one of the lessons I take from this, though, is that what precedes all formal organizing are these everyday forms of resistance. These small unknown committees become the basis of organizing and thus the foundation and the backbone for what becomes a union.
Robert Ovetz is my guest. He's author of When Workers Shot Back, Class Conflict from 1877 to 1921. So, Robert, you write that worker-instigated disruption of industry put not only the outcome of the war, World War I, in doubt, but also the survival of capitalism in doubt. The very survival of capitalism was threatened?
Yes. And here's why. Is that at a time when nationalism was literally being forced down the American population's throat, just a kind of real quick historical recount, Wilson runs for re-election on keeping us out of the war. When he gets into office, he sets up the Committee on Public Information, and they train hundreds of thousands of propagandists who go into the smallest communities and wave the flag and call for us going into the war to help the Allies. They carry out a propaganda campaign against Germans, literally putting out posters showing Germans eating babies. The height of nationalism and war fever is happening at the same time that these workers are actually disrupting war production, putting the very country's national security at stake. And to me, this is one of the most vulnerable periods in American history, although it's been forgotten and rarely studied. And we just passed the 100th anniversary of World War I, because at a time when the country is embroiled in a war, a brutal, bloody war in Europe, workers who otherwise, if you probably asked them personally, would express the most patriotic nationalist ideas, are actually undermining the war effort. And it demonstrates to me the amount of leverage that exists that during World War I, if these workers hadn't gone back to work, if they had actually circulated their struggles through the whole country or even into Canada and Mexico much more than they did, they could have actually brought the economy to a stop. And perhaps, and this is what syndicalists and the wobblies who were calling for at the time, taking over production and transform the economy into something very different. And that's why that one IAM metal worker organizer, Lavitt, was so ferociously attacked because he actually advocated for worker control. So at that point, capitalism was at its most vulnerable period in the last century.
Well, then, is one of the lessons of this part of your book, is it that, you know, for worker power to really emerge and to be strong, not just militant, but strong, you have to have a labor shortage. You have to have industries which the national government is really relying on for something critical, right? For a war effort, for keeping the nation somehow going. And if that's so, then are workers and our unions sort of at the mercy of circumstances? You know, if there isn't a labor, if there's a labor surplus, they really can't do much. If there's not a war going on, they can't do much. I mean, to what extent do circumstances like those dictate what workers are able to achieve, the leverage that workers are able to have?
I don't think this is a universal theory. You know, the conditions are going to be different. Again, you've got to study the technical composition of capital and understand how you can recompose workers' power. So some of those factors may or may not exist, but you have to understand the places where capital is most vulnerable to find those choke points, what Manuel Ness calls choke points in his recent book. And in those choke points, even if you have high rates of unemployment, you're able to disrupt the national or global economy. You have tremendous power to extract changes. So even in a depression during the 1930s, workers had tremendous leverage. And that's part of what really prompted the National Labor Relations Act to be passed, was they were threatening to disrupt an economy that was already on its knees. The Democrats essentially stepped in to save capitalism. So I think you have to look at how the conditions change in each period. And if you're aware of those conditions and the organization of capital, and asserting workers' power in those places, you can either bring about tremendous reform or potentially system change.
Robert Ovetz, O-V-E-T-Z. He teaches political science at San Jose State University and also at De Anza College. And he is the author of a new book. It's called When Workers Shot Back, Class Conflict from 1877 to 1921. It is published by Brill. Thanks so much, Robert, for your work and for joining us today.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure to be here. I know my book currently is not widely accessible, but in the fall of 2019, it'll be republished on paper by Haymarket Press.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.